Hey Clark County, it's BT Michaels here with Brad Richardson, and we are so excited to bring you the first episode of Our Backyard. What is Our Backyard? Well, to show all about the ins and the outs and the fun and the oddities of our local area here in Vancouver and Clark County. So buckle in and join us for this adventure, because it's not possible without you, the listeners, and without our partners here at KXRW and our friends at X-Ray FM. See you in a minute.
You're listening to Our Backyard, KXRW.LP Vancouver on 99.9 FM.
Today's guest of honor, Pat Gelada, local writer, historian, and keeper of our dark secrets. But before we get to that, let's see how Brad's doing.
Do you have the first show jitters?
Not at all. No, cool and calm here. Cool and calm.
Calm as a cucumber.
I'm just dead inside, so
that's the secret to radio, kids. I just don't know, I just can't shake like first show jitters, you know, trying to figure out like what is the working formula for having fun.
This is really all about what entertains me. I really don't care.
I was thinking about that. No. I mean, there's an element of truth to that, right? Like how can I be entertaining to myself?
Yeah.
And then hopefully everyone just kind of jumps on the Our Backyard bandwagon.
Exactly. They get on the train. We're going down this track. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, no, an adventure. It's like an adventure. Absolute adventure. I was thinking about like, okay, like how big? How big do you make a show? Or how small do you make a show?
It's true.
Like what elements like will people remember? And it's like I don't want to be like, hey, yeah, I'm one of the hosts of Our Backyard. And they're like, what? I don't where?
Huh? What are you talking about?
Yeah, what is
get this? Out of my yard.
Yeah, right. Sir, it is 3 a.m. and you are standing in my room.
I mean, I thought this was just standing in someone's backyard just screaming at their window at 3 a.m, right? That's what we're
show
doing.
Show idea.
Right?
Is by that the what way, we're doing? That's what we should be doing. We're gonna come live to you from your own backyard.
Yeah, we're just gonna stand in your backyard and scream at your windows.
You don't even need to apply to have it. We're just gonna show up to your backyard, whoever you are at this time, and just start talking to your windows.
There it is. You're going to hear some history, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, it's our backyard.
It's our backyard. It's not yours. I mean, we own it for the time in which we are occupying it.
That's true.
Squatter's rights.
That's right.
You know what? Speaking of my yard and squatter's rights, mm-hmm. I saw a peacock in my yard the other day.
Get out.
It was strange. I live on a mountain. There shouldn't be peacocks up there.
Where did a peacock come from?
I don't know, but what happened is word around the neighborhood started to spread of this random peacock, and we're new to the mountain area.
Okay.
And so the neighbors started through their network to spread that we were the crazy peacock people that had brought our peacock and let
That's
it loose.
That's what happens. Yeah.
That's what happens. This peacock, and he was in my yard, and I'm getting blamed for him. So I just want to make the record straight. That was not my peacock.
I don't know. I'm going to go with it. I just like in that way, when you move off the mountain, if you ever decide to move off the mountain, there will be a legend, an urban legend about the peacock man.
Oh, but the thing is that it won't be. It won't be the legend, because I've met my neighbors, and the legend that I've been told that I now have to verify historically is there's a whale on the mountain.
There's a whale on the mountain.
Someone said there is a whale somewhere on our mountain.
Like alive?
No.
No, there's just a whale.
Leavings of a whale.
Leavings of and a peacock.
And a random peacock. I've also heard there are pigs that run free and lots of other interesting animals.
Did you move in with Dr. Doolittle?
I don't know. But hearing this tale of these random animals and a whale of a tale, yeah.
That's absolutely insane to me. I don't have any cool legends where I live. I mean, I live down closer to the river.
Yeah.
So all my legends are like, they just don't exist, because nothing really fascinating happens down, at least in my chunk.
They just don't. River. They don't chill with whales down where you're at.
Which is weird, because I live right on the river. You think if anywhere, that's where the whale would be.
Not up on a mountain with creeks and no river.
Not a mountain whale.
Yeah, like we've got an old mountain whale up here. Mountain whales, mountain peacocks.
That is insane to me.
And that was in my front yard.
The peacock was?
Yeah. I mean, I could call it my backyard. It's really subjective, my yard. It kind of is wherever I want it to be.
That's true. This is my yard in my kitchen. Okay, it's laminate, but it's still my yard within the kitchen. Well, while we find you some professional help, let's go ahead and get going on our show.
All right.
news of the past. Real people, real problems. Right here on KXRW. October 5th, 1872. Reported that a contract for building a new fire engine house could cost an outstanding $1,047, aka half of my power bill this month. Contract had been let to Heitman and Walsh. October 12, 1877. A moderate earthquake shook Clark County. No casualties reported. Vancouver is reported as stating, quote, "Don't look at us, it was not our fault," end quote. October 13, 1879. Ex-President Grant returns homeward from his trip around the world, visiting Vancouver. His arrival at the government wharf was greeted by a 21-gun salute and by military and civilian officialdom. Parade and fireworks quickly followed. The following day, a great reception was held at the public park. Following the speech, while en route to Portland, Grant's steamer briefly ran aground, prompting Grant to state to his wife, quote, "Julia, you ought to be satisfied now. We've gone to the bottom at last," end quote. Perhaps recording the first official dad joke challenge in Clark County history. Last but certainly not least, October 11th, 1881. The first annual fair of the Clark County Agricultural and Mechanical Society, which had recently purchased 28 acres of the Durgan Farm near Vancouver and erected a 40 by 60 foot pavilion, was opened. Everything from agricultural products, farm machinery, stock, baked goods, and fine arts were exhibited. The weather was unsteady. S.W. Brown, president, pronounced the fair a, quote, "fair success," end quote, flexing his funny bone and dropping a dad joke challenge in response to President Grant, who has been holding the gauntlet for 2 years now.
That's your news of the past, brought to you by KXRW. Real people with real problems. Now back to your regularly scheduled program with BT Michaels and Brad Richardson. Two people with lots of problems.
KXRW would like to thank Craft Cannabis, our exclusive cannabis sponsor, for supporting our radio community. Their wide variety of products range from edibles, pre-rolls, concentrates, vapes, CBD topicals, tinctures, and much more. Craft Cannabis for 21 and over now has two locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway next to Home Depot. The Mill Plain location is in the Heights Shopping Center. Ordering options include online, in-person, curbside, and express window touchless pickup to better serve you. Hours and more information available at craftcannabis.com.
KXRW programming is made possible by the generous support by David Dansky with David's Toys, buyer and collector of old toy trains, including Lionel, Flyer, Ives, and Marks. He is interested in buying old transportation-related toys as well as toy trains from the late 1800s to the 1960s. David offers appraisals for fellow toy train lovers as well. David's Toys can be reached at 360-576-1602. That's 360-576-1602.
We brought in a local legend into our studio.
Oh, yeah.
And I am very excited.
Today, it is my honor to be able to introduce Pat Gelada, local author, historian, former city council member, and all-around local legend. So welcome to the show, Pat.
Thank you.
So what we have here is your book list, because you have written a number of books. So we have Legendary Locals of Vancouver. We have Downtown Vancouver. We have Camas Washington, Vanishing Vancouver. And then also The Darkness Next Door, Naming Clark County. And today, we're actually here to talk about, I think, what's your ninth book that you've produced, which is Haunted Vancouver, Washington. And
that's right.
For any Pagellata fans, I've missed a number of books in my list, just so you know.
And it's if you haven't read it, it is a fantastic read. It is so fun to dive into kind of like the spirit realm of our area. It brings such a different picture, especially this time of year, being October.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. It is ghost story time in October. But here's my deep, dark secret. It's hard history wrapped in a ghost story.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Because in order to tell the story, you have to build what was behind it, what was going on. You know, your favorite ghost story is the restaurant at 21st and Main. And so you have to talk, why did he build his house there? Because the streetcar ran in front of his house and he could take it to his jewelry store downtown. Perfect. And then when you look at Main Street, knowing the streetcar was there, you see a development along the lines of rapid transportation, which is to use my old sociology. But it is. It's very definitely a development along transportation lines.
Yeah, and that's the J.J. Beauregard house, the one that, and we could get into that story actually right away, because that's one that someone came and told you when you were working in the research library at the museum.
Yes, yes. This young man came into the museum, and he had lived in the house when it was a rental house, and there were scary things that happened, and he was convinced it was haunted. And I said, well, yeah, I don't know. Let's look it up.
Let's find out.
Yeah, let's find out. And it really didn't take long to find out that the tragedy did not happen in the house, but it was the wife of the man who built the house. He was going deer hunting. She went out, got on that streetcar with a gun, went down to his jewelry store and said, I know what kind of deer you're going to be hunting, and shot him down in the store. And he said, you know, don't blame her, and died. Well, they did blame her. but she was found not guilty by reason of insanity and lived out her life in that house.
Absolutely fascinating.
So I told the kid this story, and he said, well, is it her that haunts the house, or is it him? Now, that I can't tell you.
If you had to take a guess, which one would you put your dollar on?
Her.
On her? Yeah, actually, absolutely.
Yeah, because she had those years of living with what she had done in that house. And it whenever you start digging into these stories, you find strong emotion. And that, to me, would be the strongest emotion of all, is regret and grief and guilt.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, when you go back and you read legendary hauntings, it always has some sort of emotional facet to it that drives it. So I could absolutely see that being.
That's right. And that's more or less what started me on writing ghost stories. We had a lot of reference materials that developers would use to track down the history of the property they were going to build on. And we got pretty adept at checking back on properties. And then often people would come in, want to check on the background of the house to put it on the historic register. And sometimes they would come in, want to find out about their house or property. And you'd start giving them the standard, here's what it was used for, here's... That wasn't what they wanted. But they don't want to tell you what it is they wanted. And that's when you realize, this is what they're doing. And finally, after a few questions, they would say, well, yeah, we think it's haunted.
And I have to chime in as a descendant of your work at the museum, because this is, you know, your work you're doing at the museum obviously predates my time being there. But now, even though I'm there with the staff working, that's the exact same dynamic.
Yes.
People come in and they're like, well, I'm curious about this house. Uh-huh. I was wondering, when was it built? And we're like, okay, well, it was built to say, well, who lived in it? And we're like, okay, this thing. I'm like, did they die?
well, hopefully this show brings some more in there. Maybe you guys can uncover some other good stories people want to know.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's always interesting for me as someone, again, as a descendant of the institution from you, is to hear that same story being told in that same way, because then it speaks to the human condition.
Yes.
That this is how people come in and feel about this across time periods, even though we have a, you know, briefer time period.
Yeah. Yeah, they want to know. They don't want to be laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's their biggest fear, is that we'll dismiss them as loonies or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And actually, they are getting us history. And when I realized what great stories I was finding out as I talked to these people, because, you know, that changes the dynamic of the search. Now you're looking for people.
Right.
And you've got the newspapers there. And you can find the obituary, and you find out some really strange stuff. I remember one woman said that the people, when she moved in, the people moving out said, watch out for the ghost. And so it was a fairly new house. I mean, by fairly new, I'm talking 50s, 60s, right, somewhere in there. So it was easy enough to find out, just with the city directories, mm-hmm, to find out who lived there.
Good old Polks.
And then, oh, love them. Then you go to the newspapers and find their obituary. And that one started out that he died approximately November 6th to 10th. Okay, that's a little unusual. And it was 2 years before in the obituary.
Yeah.
Very odd. Now we've got to go back and find out just what the heck happened there. And what happened, they lived in this little house, and he went to take a nap and died. Well, okay, she had no idea what to do next, so she just left him there for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the bed for 2 years.
That's unbelievable.
So, neighbor called several years after that, or right at that time. Neighbor called the police and wanted him to do a welfare check because they hadn't seen her out working in the yard. And she worked in the yard every day, and all of a sudden she wasn't.
Okay.
So a friend of mine, I'm not going to mention his name. No, he was a police lieutenant and lived very nearby. And all of the sirens and everything are going by. He grabbed his video camera and ran after him. So I got to see the whole thing. They knock on the door, and through the window of the door, they can see this woman on the floor. So they force entry, go in, and she's barely conscious. She's dehydrated, badly dehydrated. And they ask her if she lives alone. She said, oh, no, I live with my husband. Well, where is he? Well, he's taking a nap. And the cobwebs had grown so deep that she was like 5 feet tall, and there was this line,
oh my God,
through the cobwebs at 5 feet.
Whoa.
And they went in the bedroom, and yeah, there he was, mummified.
You can't even make that stuff up.
No, that's, you can't.
That's a movie. That's what it sounds like.
If you were a screenwriter and you brought that to Hollywood, they would kick you out. That's They'd true. Be like, that's unrealistic. Yeah. No one would ever
that
do
doesn't
that.
Happen.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So here, you spent all of those years working at the museum in the research library. You're learning all these stories. What was the push that then got you to say, you know what, I need to make these into stories that people can read? Because yes, you had the first publication, Darkness Next Door. What was that moment like? What was the inertia?
I think it was naming Clark County.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very successful first start.
And that was your book where you went through all of these place names, yes, throughout Clark County, and you gave the history of those places, yes, which is an amazing hand guide. And not a ton of communities necessarily have something like that.
That's the fact. Cowlitz wanted me to do theirs. Mm. And they don't have the tools that we have. Mm-hmm. They don't, right, have the chronology of Clark County that we have,
yep,
that we can look this stuff up. And they don't have the collection of Polk directories and all the rest of this.
Yep.
And so I declined that request. They're going to have to find somebody on their list, not me. But because of that, I began really internalizing these stories,
mm,
and remembering them. And then I thought, and then, yeah, these are stories that I can tell history with.
Yeah. And it broadens the audience. Because every year when the haunted tours that I get to do come around, you know, newspapers and different entities will reach out and they'll always ask this one question. They'll say, is it true? And I say, you know, really, honestly, as historians and people that we're working on, what we're trying to do is not gather something for truth or fact, but what we're gathering is what is essentially modern folklore. And it's, mm-hmm, compelling stories that help tell us an understanding of how people interpret the world. And so even though it's not an event that happened at this day with this person in this room, it's still documentable history because it's about how people feel and interpret the world around them and also their fear, which is exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah. And I did tell a lie once about a ghost. I really did. This really horrible couple came into the museum and they demanded to know what had happened in their house, that their neighbors had told them it was haunted, and they wanted to know. Okay, where is it? You know, and they gave me an address on West 15th Street that's now no longer there. I said, oh, of course. Aren't you lucky? Because that was the home of Ira Cressup. And he was a police officer, and he was elected sheriff, and then he came back to be chief of police, and he guards that house. And I'll tell you, if you're a law-abiding person, you have nothing to worry about. I mean, God help you if you break the law. But that was the only fake ghost story I ever told, although it's historically true.
Well, there you go.
They laughed, and I'm sure the neighbors were very grateful.
So you have all these stories you've learned. You have the naming Clark County, and then you start work on the first book. What was that like?
Hard work. Just hard, slogging work. You know, you get pains in your shoulder blades. But my son asked me how much I make on these things. And I said, you know, not too damn much. And he said, well, then it's more a compulsion. And I think it is. You're compelled to tell these stories.
Oh, absolutely.
And I used to resent some people who wanted to charge for research like that. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're a real historian, you just want to tell that story.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you get paid for it or not. You just want to tell that story.
And I think, like how Brad alluded to it earlier, it's a whole different audience when you start writing, you know, these legends, these urban legends down. You get people who are now identifying buildings based off of, you know, these hauntings.
That's right. That's right. The Ford building, the Heritage building now, a private detective who had his office there saw a person on the mezzanine landing and described perfectly a man who was shot trying to rob the place.
Yeah, wow.
So, do I believe in ghosts? I believe that the people who told me these stories believed.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, when it's a funny experience when you get to sit down for the first time with someone who's telling you an original story. And it's funny because I'm junior in all of this, because you have all of these stories and I've maybe been told like two in person. But when they tell you, it is so compelling to feel the authenticity of what they want to communicate and say, like, I did see this. Please believe me. And they are. They're always very shy. They're like, wow. You know, it's like eventually they're like, wow. Well, I did kind of see something, so I could tell you. And then when I'm like, that's awesome. Like, what did you see? I'd love to know. And when you sit there without judgment and you just absorb and say, this is a great story. I'm not going to make a determination whether I think this is personally true in that, because I personally wasn't there. So it's not my place. But I love your story, and it helps me understand humanity, which is the humanities is what we're doing.
Yes. Well, and crime. Crime story. I did the one crime book, too.
Yeah, the John Dewey book.
And that's a best-selling book I had. All the history books. Yeah, about Joanne Dewey. That people love the murders. But I was able in that as well to talk about when she's walking down Main Street at 11 o'clock at night. And just 5 years before, it would have been bustling with people at 11 o'clock at night because of the shipyards. And we were a 24-hour town because of the shipyards. But now, 5 years later, after the war, those people have moved on.
Yep.
Yeah.
And she could hear her heels then echoing off the buildings because they were all closed down.
Yeah. And just for background for folks, because in this segment, you know, it's good for people to know the Joanne Dewey, because I mean, we have ghost stories and we have stories of terror too. Mm-hmm. And the Joanne Dewey story is a trauma that has yet to seem to leave the consciousness of Vancouverites. And so can you give just a little bit of background so people who don't know about that story have that filled in?
Certainly. Joanne missed her bus. She lived in Meadowglade. And there was a Greyhound bus that went to Meadowglade, and she had missed it. And she called her mother to come pick her up. Mother couldn't. She told her, walk up to St. Joseph's Hospital. It's a Catholic hospital, but most of the nurses were Seventh-day Adventists, as was Meadowglade. She said, spend the night there and have one of the nurses bring you home in the morning. So she commenced to walk up to St. Joseph's Hospital, got within 60 feet of the front door, and two guys jumped out of a car, beat her into submission, and drove away with her. What made that so horrible was pillars of the community stood there and watched it happen.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, there was a guy that owned the Buick agency. There was a county commissioner. I mean, these were upstanding citizens, and they said, she's my wife and she's drunk. And so they just backed away and let them beat her up. And I mean, someone, they broke her jaw. I mean, that was how bad the beating was. And these people just sat and watched. And the next morning when she didn't come home, mother calls the police, and again, some confusion as to whether it was city or county. And they turned out people to search for her. Hundreds of people turned out to search for her. And she was found several days later in Wind River in Skamania County. Mm. And the two that did it were brothers from Camas, well, from Fern Prairie. And they were found guilty and hanged. And it divided our community. The community just split wide open.
Oh, I bet.
Well, we had a sheriff that had never done any law enforcement. It was out of his jurisdiction, but he's giving press reports with his theory of the day. The real chief of police, who'd been on since, you know, 30 years, and his detectives all had gray hair. And he's getting angrier and angrier by the moment. But it turned out that the cops framed him because they didn't like him. They were dead guilty. And then there was a group that said those boys just needed hanging.
Yeah, I mean, the layers of that story and, you know, in the book, how you lay out each of those individuals and how they impacted that story. It's, yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild.
It was it echoes down today. Mm-hmm. There are still people that remember it and had their opinions on it. And they've all called me. Every last one of them's called me.
Well, and I feel like you even see people who were their children who have had the stories passed to them that still seem to understand this broader trauma. And what's always interesting for me when I look at some of the ghost stories, too, is that I think this idea of trauma for me has started to crystallize a little bit more, because like you look at the Slocum House, which is stated as the most haunted place in Vancouver, potentially, other than maybe the hospital. And you have so many stories and so many people that share so many things. And one of the key factors that I always hear about related to that is that the Slocums never had kids, that there was this trauma, there was this sadness that attached to the place. But then also when you look at the Slocum House, there's a broader, more general community trauma, because it's the last of the mansions that were down in that area.
Yes.
So urban renewal takes out everything. You lose a part of the body of your community, and this is kind of just the last little piece of that remaining. And so there's like these two broader and more personal trauma stories that attach to this. And that's what I feel like I start to see more and more with some of these histories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's places that are abandoned. Well, that place is left alone. That's a traumatic moment. It's places that are in disrepair. Oh, it's hurt. That's a trauma moment. And it's just fascinating. And with the Haunted Vancouver, or the Haunted History of Vancouver, you have so many of those stories. And obviously, we could probably do the show for 3 days.
No, absolutely.
But what's just a handful? Could you just tell us ones that you'd that always stick with you?
Goodness, of course there is. The barracks is a treasure trove of ghost stories. It really is. And there are stories of a bugle being heard. And there was a bugle boy. They had them. They were 12, 13-year-old kids. And this particular bugle boy got drunk. and they put him in the guardhouse. And I guess he was an obnoxious little creep because the guards smacked him around and he died in the guardhouse. Probably at his age, I would guess alcohol poisoning combined with everything else. But from that time, they say they still hear the bugle going. And up and down the row. The one I love on the row, though, is it's the second house in from the freeway. And it's a bunch of engineers.
Okay.
And they were firmly convinced that there was movement around upstairs. And they could smell cigar smoke when the movement happened. So what they did as engineers, they ranged themselves down the stairway and had each one raise his hand as the smell of cigar smoke.
It's a scientist versus ghost.
Value Village. Remember Value Village? It was a secondhand store, and it's now some car company.
That was where, in the 90s, I got all of my flannels. So, you know, we could tell ghost stories of clothing's past there.
That's true.
Yeah. But know what they have. That was, at one time, a grocery store, and it was damaged in the tornado that we had, and a woman was killed.
Mm-hmm.
I think two women were killed in the doorway of that.
And was that the 60s or 70s when that tornado?
70s.
70s, yeah.
And killed a woman in the bowling alley across the way. But when it was Value Village, they would have toys knocked off the shelf, and they would stack them up again, and they would come in the next morning, they'd be on the floor again.
Oh, man.
So
gives me the heebie-jeebies a little.
And, of course, there is the museum, but I have never found anything that happened in the museum to warrant those.
Maybe it's brought on by the memories that are preserved in the museum.
Oh, maybe you brought something in. Yeah.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah. It's all my fault. Yeah.
But jumping back really quick, because I was fascinated when reading, especially about the history, like in the barracks and on the base. You don't hear a lot of that outside of, you know, what you've written. So how are you coming across this information, especially for, you know, on the fort?
Because it was in newspapers. Okay. You know, first it's told to me by people, and the Independent and the Columbian used to have a section that was of the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it just took a lot of digging, just digging. And mostly from newspapers. And we have some oral histories that have been described or copied down.
Yeah.
And there are some tidbits in there in the oral history. It's just looking through everything. I want at least two references.
Okay.
Yep.
And the more references, which is why I'm not writing a book right now, because you're limited to 30 minutes still at the computer in the library.
I think we're still working on that.
Yeah.
I'm one who can spend all day in there going through newspapers. And so what I have is, what I want to write about is the Prohibition era here in Clark County.
Yep.
And it was not just the booze. It was our general lapse into lawlessness and how we changed so much in the Prohibition years.
Right.
And we killed two Prohibition agents. Jesse Brewer, was that his name? I'd have to look that up.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesse, anyway, his granddaughter was my, good thing I don't have the name. His granddaughter was my contractor when I redid my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking and she says, you know, that remembered when he got paroled from prison and nobody would talk about it. But then someone said he had killed a policeman. And I said, killed two. Two. And that's when I brought her down to the museum, pulled out the newspaper, and let her actually read the story of this fellow. And the 3 days later, Prohibition was repealed.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and what you're bringing to light is something that I think folks, when they think of traditional academic history, there's a certain way that that's done. And what I don't think people always understand is local and public history is done differently. Like academic is, you're working with an archive and sources traditionally, or at least a knowledge of something broader mm-hmm. that like is well established, and you go down to the archive and you pull the box and you go through the files and you look at all the stuff. And you then synthesize and try to say, what is this saying? You try to create an argument and you try to you know, prove that with all that evidence. Local history often starts with leads that are informal in conversation. And I can't tell you how many times I've said to people, hey, here's my card. Can you send me an email with just a couple sentences about what you just told me? Because I'd love to try to unpack this. And what it is you're kind of getting these boxes of history that then you're like opening up and trying to unpack by going into the archives and going into a newspaper. And when we do local exhibits or local books or local programs, there is nothing that is all stuck in the same place that you just open the file and it's all there.
No, it's everywhere.
It's a scavenger hunt for local history. And what you then do, and what you've done, Pat, for so many years, is you're then creating the future archive for those local folks.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff, when we go look to your books or to the materials that you've accumulated, or when I, you know, reach out and I say, hey, do you have this in your files? You're creating the archive that traditionally the academics have easy access to, but locally we have it in a very disparate and kind of, like I said, scavenger hunt manner. And that is so valuable, because what happens is you and I, when we do that, when we hear that informal story, we pluck it out of the ether and then we drop it down and we look at it and say, okay, well, what is this? And where can I find that? Where can I find that? We're doing the first draft. Then future generations get to come back and say, okay, well, they looked at that, but now I see this. What does this make it, you know, and that? And then they get to chance to almost take the clay that we've laid out and start to really sculpt a picture. Yeah. And that's where local history and how local history acts.
There's another library too, and that's the people.
Yeah.
That's why I keep sending people to you.
Yeah. The growing up in Vancouver, Facebook group is like it's an archive made of people that has information we could never obtain any other way than them sharing it because it's not documented in a book or in a newspaper.
Yeah. Cardboard Hill. Would mm-hmm. you ever find Cardboard Hill anywhere? No.
No.
Because it was just kids at David Douglas Park laying down cardboard and sliding down the hill. That's history. That really is a part of growing up in Vancouver.
Yeah. And wasn't it with, and let me know if you're willing to share this story, because this is one of the ones you told me recently I love. And it's part connected, I think, to growing up in Vancouver. It was the pie shop, because the growing up in Vancouver crew met up at the pie shop, and then you connected with the owner about there's a ghost story connected to that. The one that's up in, I think, Carter Park neighborhood?
Oh, yes. I know exactly the one on Columbia Street.
Yep.
And yes, that was another, you know, a tragic story all told. And the woman inherited the shop. She's still there. And that was one that was so documented because the people that ran it, more than one person who ran it, had seen that person. And the employees had seen it. And one had a pot thrown at her in the kitchen. And
wow. Was
all those wonderful stories. And it's just, once you've done ghost stories, by the way, everybody's going to call you with a new one. And so you just have to be prepared for that you are now the ghost story person.
And if I'm remembering correctly, that story had something to do with a mirror or something that was uncovered.
Yes. They pulled down a wall, and there was a mirror behind it. And it was so dirty from being in the wall for so long. And she tried to clean it, you know, useless. Called a professional, and he's seeing things in the mirror. And he didn't think they should have uncovered it.
Oh, wow.
Because he's seeing people in the mirror.
Oh, man.
And Yeah. They're great stories. They're great stories, and they keep people interested.
Right.
Yeah.
While you're feeding them the story of the past.
So you know, Haunted Vancouver is the one that you just put out.
Yeah.
And we talked about the, you know, before we started recording, the cutting room floor. So you didn't do a haunted battleground or a haunted canvas or any of those. What stories outside of Vancouver have been kind of left not on the written page?
Oh, well, if I didn't write them down, I wouldn't know them, would I? Because I did do the Darkness Next Door, which was the whole county.
Yep.
And there was, in Battleground, you mentioned, there was Ananasco, mm-hmm. was her name, little girl. And she is seen by train crews going through Battleground, standing at the side of the road. And whenever you have somebody seeing something, like the ghost on the interstate bridge, it's mm-hmm. always, they're seen as you're moving.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Ananasco is the same thing. And that was pretty awful. A fella kidnapped her, beat her to death, dumped her body. And they found out who it was, and they advanced on his house with torches. And they were going to burn the house down with him in it.
Oh, wow.
Until the sheriff actually came mm-hmm. and rescued the guy who had done the murder. And they found the sock filled with the metal objects mm-hmm. that he'd used to beat her to. And that was the Ananasco story. That one has stuck with me.
Yeah.
For so long that, you know, we think of lynching as something far in the past. But you know, these people were so infuriated and bent on vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That yeah. It was the mob mentality took over, and the guy was just lucky the sheriff showed up. Mm. But there are these stories all over. You could probably go to most museums and find somebody who has ghost stories to tell you.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. No, I mean, and older buildings, you know, you always, it's funny, I'll be doing some walking tours or, you know, going around and just chatting with folks in the community that have businesses. And every time I'm in an older building, I'm like, well, do you guys see anything? and you know, it's about 75% of the time they're like, oh yeah, like our bar weekend bartender, he's got a bunch of stories. I'll have him reach out to you. And there is just so many stories out there. And that's the wild thing about it. And for you with Haunted Vancouver, is there more you're looking in the future to gather and possibly write
absolutely.
Up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and then I begin to wonder, what happens to these apparitions when they lose their housing? I mean, what happens when the bridge comes down? What happens to the mayor on the bridge? The Inn at the Key is dreadfully haunted. Yeah. I mean, just incredibly haunted. And it's going to come down.
The Pfister House came down.
Oh, did it?
Right? It's gone. That's where...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I don't remember exactly. What was that story
with the Pfister? Pfister House on 11th. Mm-hmm. He was a Medal of Honor recipient.
Yeah, he's up at the cemetery.
Yes, and they promised me they were going to take... I knew the house was going to come down.
Mm-hmm.
It was too much in the... They promised me they would take photographs.
Mm.
I don't know if they ever did or not.
Yeah, I haven't heard. Mm. And what was the activity in that house?
That was him. Mm-hmm. He died of tuberculosis, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he had built the house by hand, by himself.
Yeah.
And then never got to live in it.
Yeah.
Really. Oh.
Because he passed away right around the completion.
Yes.
And then they would hear just things happening.
It's, I had a fun time today on Facebook with a fella who, there was a picture of the Marshall House, mm-hmm. several pictures of the Marshall House. And he remembered catching pigeons in that house. What the hell? Okay. And then he was so glad that they had saved it and relocated it. And it dawned on me. He's talking about the Slocum House.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I had a photograph in my file of the Slocum House in its original place.
Mm-hmm.
So I posted that for him. It, you know, he didn't get angry. He just, you know, he said, oh boy, was I ever wrong. And he said, I really pictured it in my mind as the Marshall House.
Yeah.
I said, well, in my early memories, everything is much bigger than it really is. So
no, absolutely. You were talking about all the, you know, interviews and people coming forward to tell you these stories, and I just started thinking about like the politics of memory and how we all develop these legends in our head, and they're all a little bit different, but you know, they all have one common theme, one thread that runs through it all that kind of binds it all together. And so that's why these books are just so fascinating, because it's the politics of memory. It's how we remember these legends and these myths. And
and we add to them. We add a little flair.
Absolutely.
Of our own to them. And it's sometimes being a, I used to say that being a museum curator, you describe the indescribable. Mm-hmm. You explain the unexplicable, right. And I won't tell you what we do to the inscrutables.
It's a trade secret.
But it's our job to sometimes burst that bubble.
Yeah.
Old family legends that grandpa did this or that.
Don't tie yourself to the rock that you're infallible, because you'll end up at the bottom of the river. You know, if you're out there to find out what's, you know, as true as possible, you're going to be willing to be wrong.
That's right.
So, you know, you've covered in a couple books now about the hauntings in Vancouver, but, you know, we have this new attraction, I feel like, in society right now, where we love the darker stories. We love the murder stories and the crime.
Yeah.
True crime podcast. Vancouver edition. It'd
probably do pretty well. Yeah. Have you thought about writing any more about Vancouver murders or Clark County?
Oh, yeah. Because we've had so many of them. I know one friend of mine says, Pat, I wish you would stop writing those stories. You're making Vancouver sound dangerous. We had a fella blow his parents up with dynamite, which I thought was kind of interesting.
You could write a whole book on people and dynamite in this county.
Oh, yeah. Well, they couldn't get guns.
Future episode.
Dynamite brought to you.
It's Dino what?
Well, you could buy dynamite at the hardware store.
Yep.
In those days. And so it was a real handy murder weapon. There was one in Ridgefield, which I found just fascinating. You know, you're going, what? But this, and Ira Cressup mm-hmm. was the sheriff at that time. And this fella had been shot with fishing weights.
Wow.
The guy had loaded a shotgun with fishing weights and shot him through the window. Well, that was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
And the only clue was a size 9 footprint under the window with a crack, identifiable crack in mm-hmm. the sole of the shoe. And Ira Cressup went so far as to go to every house in Ridgefield to see what size shoe everyone wore. And he finally found those shoes in the victim's closet. So rather than say, oh, the guy stood under the window before he was shot, no. And then he found out the handyman who worked there had bought fishing weights.
Mm-hmm.
At the hardware store. And then he kind of leaned on the wife and found out that she and the handyman had been having an affair.
Mm.
And
the rest is history.
That's
there,
it.
There you go.
Yeah, the rest is history. But there are so many of those stories around. Well, one of the ghost stories in Ridgefield was a family, Walker family, actually. Mm-hmm. I say that because his grandson wrote a book, 100 Years of Flight, Pearson Field.
Oh, cool.
And then went off to become a lawyer, for heaven's sake. Could have been a historian.
I think few people actually know, a lot of times when people are getting bachelor's in history and getting education, that's actually a path to law.
Yeah,
people end up going into law degrees. Because I remember I was talking to people when I was at WSU getting my my degree, and they're like, oh, hey, you're going to go teach or do some history? And I'm like, oh, no, I'm going to become a lawyer. Like, what?
Oh, every history professor I had to take pre-law. If you don't understand the law, then, you know, you don't understand history fully. So I can see that.
That's for sure. But what happened there, fella was going to blow some stumps on his farm. And he had dynamite, and it had gotten wet. So he decided to put it in the oven to dry. Well, the only one in the family that survived was the son who was out in the barn milking cows.
Oh, wow.
And that was my friend's grandfather that was out in the...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, no kidding.
So he wouldn't have been here at all.
Talk about a crisis of existence right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, the area is still supposed to be haunted. And I always said it was haunted by a guy going slapping his forehead.
He's haunting himself with that memory.
What did I do?
Stay here. I'm looking at your list. The audience isn't supposed to know I've got a list.
That's okay. We're real fourth wall kind of guys.
Yeah, right, that's true. We'll break that fourth wall. We don't even care.
Hi, you listening.
I tell you, I am compelled. Once I start writing, I don't want to stop.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get those words on the screen. I don't think I could have done it with a typewriter. Or writing on. I look at some of these manuscripts where it's all handwritten. I never could do that. No.
Well, aside from coming across like human figuration, like do you come across stories dealing with animals, hauntings by pets or mules, especially on the Fort Vancouver?
Oh yes, indeed. Yes, the ghost mules on the barracks, they have been seen several times. And one was, he won't let me tell his name because he's an airline pilot.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to go out there with his name. But he was accustomed to jog on Officer's Row. And he was doing that, and he looked down, and he saw mules. And he thought, oh, they're doing a reenactment, and nobody's known about it. Nobody, you know, nobody's written it up. They're doing this reenactment. So he jogged on down to the mule barns. No mules, no evidence that there'd been, and there would have been evidence if there had been mules.
What type of evidence?
Organic evidence. And so he turned around and came back up to the Grant House where I was working at that. It used to be a museum, you know.
Yeah, that's a whole episode in its own right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. They turned it into a restaurant and turned me into a politician in one stroke. But he wanted to know what was going on, that he would see mules. Definitely saw mules. And there were no mules. And I told him about the mule barns, or called the mule barns, because the Army traveled on mules.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why West Point has the Army mules.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've got a photograph in the museum of the Army mules. And they're lined up at attention. Their ears are all straight up. How do you get a mule to come to attention? Did you ever think about that? No. But the photographer sets up, and they bring the mules out, and the mules are doing what mules usually do, which is look around and talk to each other. And so the guy who ordinarily feeds them would step behind the photographer and hit a pan with a spoon.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
All the ears come up, and they're intently. So if you ever have to get a mule at attention, that's how you do it.
I think I'm going to test that theory. That sounds interesting.
Do like a mini cast of
that's
that.
That's true. Like bringing mules to attention.
Bringing mules to attention. Yes. With Brandon and Brad.
Well, Pat, it was fantastic for you to come in, and I could not think of a more amazing person to come in on, especially on our first broadcast for this.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pat. Oh, really appreciate it.
A big thank you to Vancouver's own Kagan's Theatre for supporting our radio community. Our historic Kagan's Theatre has a long tradition of showing movies for our community, 85 years. Kagan's currently features first-run big studio and art house films along with classic movie revival. Check out their live events, and you can even book the theater for a private party or public event. Go to kagans.theater.com to see how you can rediscover the joy of going out for movie night again. Showtimes, booking information, and more at kagans.theater.com.
Attention, please.
Attention, please.
This is gonna be an event.
Attention, please.
And now your local history calendar.
The Spooky Edition.
The Clark County Historical Museum is conducting haunted walking tours of downtown Vancouver every Friday and Saturday at 6 p.m. in October. Visit cchmuseum.org for more information. Throughout the month of October, join Jeff Davis with Spirit Tales for haunted tours of Officers Row and Vancouver Barracks. For more information, go to vanbksghostwalk.eventsmart.com. Last but not least, join on a haunted tour of downtown Camas presented by White Light Paranormal Institute on Friday, October 15th at 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. For more information, visit the Downtown Camas Association Facebook page and click on events.
This has been your events calendar, brought to you by KXRW and X-Ray FM.
Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at ADCO1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com.
Hey, Clark County, thank you so much for joining Brad and I on our first episode of Our Backyard. I hope it was enlightening and not too spooky for you. Join us in November as we talk to Dan Wyatt of the Kiggins Theater as he tells us about the past and the present and where they see themselves going in the future. Also, we're going to dive into the hidden history of this famous Vancouver landmark that was acclaimed as one of the most modern and luxurious theaters in the Pacific Northwest. Last but not least, it is October, which means it is National A Lot of Things Month. So to kind of cover our grounds, it is National ADD and ADHD Awareness Month, National Animal Safety and Protection Month, Apple Month, and Squirrel Awareness Month. Now, don't get that confused with National Squirrel Day, which is held in January. This is a whole month for our little furry friends. It is also Breast Cancer Awareness Month globally, and if you are our Canadian listeners and our Canadian friends, it is Autism Awareness Month. So as you go about your month, make sure you stop, listen, and learn so we can do our part in spreading awareness. As always, stay safe, stay healthy, join us next month. We'll see you around town, Vancouver.